Hey everyone, it's Masioka. You're listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Greetings to all my fellow geeky guys and gals out there. Welcome to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. I am your host, Joe Stuber. I am back in the lair again. So glad you could join me this week. Another amazing episode on tap for today. Look, we all love superheroes. That's why we're here. The NBC TV hit Heroes, that television show brought us a bunch of superheroes. One hero was even named Hero on the show, and he's going to be joining me shortly. Actor Masioka will be along in just a bit. He just wrapped up 7 years on Hawaii Five-0. Nice run on that. It was a CBS crime drama. His final episode is streaming online as we speak. We're going to talk about Hawaii Five-0. We're going to talk about Star Wars. Yeah, some Star Wars talk today. Of course, Heroes Reborn. That conversation is coming up. By the way, if you are a fan of those shows, Heroes and Heroes Reborn, there's a good chance you're a fan if you're tuning in today. If you haven't already, after today's conversation with Masi, you're going to want to check out these classic episodes of Comic Book Central. Episode 84, that was my chat with Zachary Levi from Heroes Reborn. Episode 86, Adrian Pasdar from Heroes. And episode 94, Greg Grunberg from Heroes and Heroes Reborn. Speaking of Star Wars, he was in Star Wars The Force Awakens as well. So check those conversations if you haven't heard them yet. Fun chats with those gents. Couple of other things to get to today before we get to Masioka. Speaking of fun conversations, I had one recently with my buddy and fellow podcaster Derek Cook over on Monster Kid Radio. I've been over there in Monster Kid Radio Land before talking about the Abbott and Costello Monster movies. We did a bunch of those. That was fun. We also talked about Superman and the Mole Men on one episode, so that was cool. This time around, Derek and I are going to be talking about the 1960s stop-motion animation classic Mad Monster Party. That's right. If you've seen it, it's pretty cool. I believe that episode of Monster Kid Radio is going to be online in early February. When I have the date, I'll let you know. But great idea to just go into iTunes, subscribe to Monster Kid Radio. That way you won't miss the episode. You can check out every episode. Derek just celebrated his 300th episode recently, so he's been doing this for quite a while. If you haven't already, subscribe to Monster Kid Radio and iTunes. Subscribe to Comic Book Central on iTunes, of course, if you haven't done that already, if you're there. Leave a review for those shows. That always helps. We appreciate when you do that. So Monster Kid Radio is coming up. We are going to get that Mad Monster Party started soon.
Prepare for a spine-tingling, nerve-shattering podcast featuring all your favorite monsters. You won't believe your ears when you listen to Monster Kid Radio. Hear your host, Derek M. Cook, and his ever-rotating stable of guests discuss your favorite classics and sometimes not-so-classic monster movies. Subscribe to Monster Kid Radio through iTunes or Stitcher, or visit monsterkidradio.net before the next weekly episode of Monster Kid Radio. Go through the archives for interviews with Sarah Karloff, Victoria Price, and Joel Hodson. Listen to discussions about movies like Creature from the Black Lagoon, Island of Terror, and King Kong. And don't forget convention coverage from Monster Bash and the H.P. Lovecraft Film Festival, Classic Monsters, Modern Talk, and the Head of Rondo Hatton, only on Monster Kid Radio.
And one final piece of business before we get to today's chat. I want to announce the recipient of my Arrow Season 3 Blu-ray giveaway. That's right. If you remember back on episode 156, that was my interview with Arrow's Katrina Law, the lovely and talented Katrina Law. I mentioned on that episode that I had Season 3 to give away to one listener who shared the correct post on Facebook or retweeted the correct post on Twitter. That listener chosen is Ollie Almeida. Congratulations, Ollie. Just send me an email with your address, and Oliver Queen, the rest of Team Arrow, all that Season 3 Arrow goodness, including Katrina Law as Nissa Al Ghul, Season 3 on Blu-ray is headed your way. Thank you for sharing it, that post. Thanks to everyone who got the word out about that episode. If you did share that pin post on Facebook, or if you retweeted on Twitter and you weren't selected, don't despair, true believers. I've got more Arrow giveaways in the weeks and months ahead, so that is coming up. Man, stay tuned to Comic Book Central. Got some more of those to give away. And I've got a Flash giveaway for the return of Flashback Flash Forward February on Comic Book Central. We're going to do that again this year. So got a Flash giveaway coming up for that. We are just weeks away from that. So don't you dare miss a moment of what is coming up. Hey, always a good idea to share the lair each and every week. You get the word out about the show. I always appreciate that. But it's nice when I get to share something with you in the process too. So you keep sharing the show. Get some more giveaways heading your way. All right, what I want to share with you right now is a little bit of background on my special guest. So kick back, grab a beverage, take a listen to this, and then I'm going to be right back to talk with Masioka. Masi was born in Tokyo, Japan, and he moved to Los Angeles with his mother when he was 6 years old. After attending schools in Los Angeles, he graduated from Brown University with a degree in mathematics and computer science, which eventually led him to that galaxy far, far away. Well, it was actually back to the West Coast where he landed a gig with Industrial Light and Magic, the Oscar-winning special effects house created by George Lucas. And when Masi wasn't creating spaceships or helping to bring comic book characters to life through state-of-the-art digital effects at ILM, he was inhabiting characters himself through acting roles on television shows like Dharma and Greg, Gilmore Girls and Scrubs, and feature films like Austin Powers in Goldmember. In 2006, writer-producer Tim Kring's super-powered show Heroes premiered on NBC, and Masi scored his most high-profile role to date, that of Hiro Nakamura, an average office worker who discovers he can bend the rules of time and space. And the globe-spanning show about ordinary people with extraordinary abilities was an instant hit, and Hiro was a breakout character, thanks in part to a memorable scene in that very first episode where Hiro transports himself from Japan to New York City in the heart of Times Square. And he launched a catchphrase in the process. Hiro soon discovers he is part of something much bigger, and viewers got a glimpse of that as Hiro from the future set the first season mission in motion.
Peter Petrelli.
What? Are you doing this?
You look different without the scar.
I don't know you.
Not yet. My name is Hiro Nakamura. I'm from the future, and I have a message for you. I don't have much time. I'm risking a rift just by coming here. The girl, you have to save her.
What girl?
The cheerleader. It's the only way to prevent it.
Prevent what?
Everything. Listen to me. She must live.
Wait! Save the cheerleader, save the world!
For the 2015 follow-up series, Heroes Reborn, Masi returned for a couple of episodes, and we were left with a cliffhanger for Hiro as he squared off swords in hand against a bunch of evil clones. Now joining me now is a talented actor who just wrapped a hugely successful run on the CBS hit drama Hawaii Five-0. We, of course, also know him for his Emmy-nominated performance as Hiro Nakamura on the sci-fi superhero show Heroes. A big welcome to Masioka. Masi, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. Congratulations on your successful run on Hawaii Five-0.
Thank you very much.
Okay, 7 years, man, 136 episodes, and Max Bergman, he made it out, right? I mean, he's good to go. Okay.
it's quite surprising, you know. It's kind of hard to believe that it's actually longer than Heroes, but, you know, it's been 7 years.
Well, you still got a ways to go for the original Hawaii Five-0. I think that was, what, 12 seasons?
Yeah, that's a long ways to go. But
that's a long time to commit. Look, we know crime shows, they're always killing off characters. So I think this is actually going to air after your final episode. But we know you made it out because I think you've said in other interviews you're getting a nice send off. So when.
Yeah.
OK, it's a successful franchise. I guess the immediate question people have is why leave? And especially like halfway through a season. What was the thought behind that?
Well, it's, you know, I've been very, very fortunate and, you know, very grateful to be on a hit show for 7 years. At the same time, you know, I think the character, just at the end of last year, he went off to Africa and he got married. And I think what's left for him, there's really not much left for him to do on the show. I mean, it's a procedural, so every week he's going to be talking about, you know, the autopsy, you know, and the cause of death COD of the week. It's kind of like becoming like bingo, because you're going to hear Max Bergman say, oh, blunt force trauma, or petechial hemorrhaging, or liver temperature. I can play bingo, but I've realized, I'm starting to repeat a lot of the words I say, and I feel like I'm becoming an expert on all these medical terminology. But at the same time, I felt his character arc did reach a climax, and the only thing you can really explore is his love life, his married life. But we also know Rumor, who plays Sabrina, is busy off doing other stuff, so that was never going to happen. So I just thought it was a nice point for the character's arc, going to Africa, getting married, and just made me think about my journey as well. And I'm very grateful to be on a show, and I just thought it was the right time to get off. And at the same time, this is my 7th year, and I've been commuting to Hawaii 18 times a year for this show. I've been on the plane longer than I have actually been on the ground or shooting at times. And I think it just took a little bit of a physical toll, especially I wanted to take care of my mother, who's going through some stuff in LA, and as well as a lot of my business who happens to be in LA or Japan. Okay. And because of all the traveling, it's hard to plan anything or set up anything, and because it takes about 2 days to go and come back, and sometimes three or more. So that's why, I think after 7 years, after 100 round trips to Hawaii, say thank you very much. But it's time for a new adventure.
Yeah, because you're one of the few actors on the show that everybody lives there, right? For the most part.
Yes, absolutely. Everybody else lives there.
Okay, and so I guess that's the tough thing as an actor too, because you're always looking for steady work. I mean, because in that business, it's always you never know what you're going to get. So you get something like that, but then, like you said, how much can you do with a character? How much does that impact you as an actor when you are kind of maybe reading the same lines over, or maybe you're not getting to go out and solve some crimes and, in the field?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a huge show, and I'm never going to be the face of the show like I was on Heroes. So I know what I'm set out to do. And if it was in LA, I'd do that gig forever. I love it. It's great. Because it is a great crew. It's a great cast, great writers, and a great fan base. So I would love to do that, but it is definitely all the timing and then the other opportunities that it costs because of the time and et cetera. So I think that's, I'm very grateful to be working, but and you're right. You never know what's around the corner for us actors. So, I shouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth, but at the same time, there just comes to be a point where it's like, okay, it's time to take a leap of faith and see what happens. And fortunately, I have a lot of other projects in the works, And the other thing also is, like you kind of mentioned at the top, that Max made it alive out. And ironically, I joked with Peter Lenkoff, our showrunner and creator of the show. I told him, like, hey, look, I want to help out the show however I can, because, because I do love the show. So if you want to kill me off, go ahead and do it.
But I read that in an interview. I can't believe you even said that, because that, like, no actor is ever going to say that.
No, because for me, it's, I'm leaving on my own quote unquote selfish reasons, so I want to be helpful to the show. I want to give back to, the fans, or give back to, Peter and CBS, who's helped me out. So, I want to see whatever I can do to help the show, because I don't want the show to die. It's just my character that's moving, I want to help it out by leaving it somehow. So yeah, the one thing I was really happy about is that they gave Max Bergman a nice farewell. And the one thing I never get to do in any show is to say a goodbye. With Heroes, we were canceled. Heroes Reborn was also re-canceled in some senses, And I've been on guest stars on every show, on their show. So I never got to say goodbye to the fans, to the cast, to the crew. So this was the first time in my TV career where I got to say goodbye. So I was really, it was a very melancholy feeling, but I was really happy in some senses.
And we saw the trailer, we saw the promo for this episode. It's like you're at a party saying goodbye and, saying, did they incorporate that set party into the real party? Are we seeing blending of life and art here?
No, I mean, there is a blending of life and art for my character, because when I was saying those words, it was literally me saying goodbye to everybody. It's not just Max. It was definitely a lot of B in there. And some of the words I changed because that's how I felt. So the words really actually came very naturally to me. And so did the emotions. But, you know, everybody had to work the next day. It was like a Wednesday night shooting. So there wasn't any after party. It was very quick. It was casual.
Did they have an actual after party for it? Like, did you get a proper send off in real life?
I didn't get a proper send off in real life. No.
Oh, but, they got to do that. It's Hawaii. You should have had like a whole luau.
No, but I was leaving the next day. I had a nice dinner. Sorry, farewell dinner with like some of the castmates. Daniel Day Kim, Grace Park came out with me. You know, Sean McBride. You know, sent me a champagne bottle. So I had a nice goodbye. You know, privately. I didn't need to like stop everybody's workflow and say, "Hey guys, I want a party before I leave." You know,
they should have shot that scene on a Friday and give. Oh,
I know you guys are working tomorrow morning at 5 a.m., but through that, we're partying till all night. It's like, yeah, I can't ask.
You'd have like three people at the party, so
I know.
Well, but the good thing is you can guest star, so you can still come back, and they can have a party later. They can have it down the road.
We'll have it down the road. So
that'll be cool.
That's all I just wanted to say. So just thank you to everybody and thank you to all the fans for all your support.
Well, good on you. Good on you. And what a run on that too. You mentioned your mom, single mom raising you in Japan.
So raising me here in LA. She moved when I was six.
Okay. So. Well, you're hero time travels. Let's time travel a little bit. Let's go all the way back. Take us back to some of those early years. What were those early years? What do you remember about being in Japan and then moving to the States and then learning a whole new culture?
Well, I attended an international school in the kindergarten years. So, you know, I kind of grew up speaking Japanese, but also with English. And I remember, I think our principal, her last name was Doi, I think. She was a graduate of Juilliard, and she was the one who actually suggested and recommended I go to the United States. And so my mom, you know, just packed up everything and pretty much gave her life to me so I could have a good education and a good career. So,
okay. You mentioned that packed up everything. I mean, I know we sort of time compressed that, but what was that like on her? How was that impact? 'Cause that's huge. That's a huge move to do that, especially a single mom raising a child.
Right. I mean, I can only guess because, you know, I was 5 years old when that all happened.
Yeah. Has she talked to you at all about it? Like,
no, I mean, Asian moms don't really talk about their struggles as much. You know, they want to be the strong mother, but you know, I can imagine all the things she had to go through. I mean, like, cause I remember she was going to college and she gave up her, you know, she was still in college at that time. So, you know, she kind of went to Pierce College when she moved to LA, you know, probably stopped her own education to provide for me and make things work out. So,
wow, that's just amazing too. And you know, I saw one thing you said. Okay, how does this? When did you find out you had a 180 IQ?
Well, I found out because I had to take a IQ test before I got into the school over here.
Okay, so you're how old?
I think I was five because that was prerequisite for entering the Merman School.
Okay. What does your mom say? What does anybody say when you get – that's
– I have no idea.
I saw you described it as that you guessed well that day. I think there's probably a little bit more than that though.
No, but I probably guessed well. And, you know, it's a Japanese test. So during those years, you know, it was like $1 to 360 yen or whatever, you know, 200 yen or something. So the conversion rate made it so that the yen IQ is probably, you know, IQ in Japanese was it was cheaper than IQ in the U.S.
That's well. I mean, we'll see how this plays in too, because that is amazing. Now, you were initially. I saw this Time magazine cover titled "Those Asian American Whiz Kids."
Yes.
All right. How did you get involved in being on the cover of Time magazine, and what was involved? I don't think you were in the actual article, but what was surrounding all of that?
Oh, basically, you know I went to the Merman School for the Gifted, and the photographer for that cover was a parent of one of my classmates. And I was Asian, and I looked smart. I wasn't actually smart, so that's why I'm not in the article. But I looked smart, so that's why they've put me on the cover.
Did he know you had a 180 IQ?
I don't know. I mean, it also deteriorates, as you know. It's all relative to your actual age, right? So we all kind of like normalize to 100. You know,
I'm not buying any of this because I'm looking at your resume here too, and I'm not buying any of that. You did some amazing things. Okay, before we get into the acting, what were some of your early influences? Were you watching American television? I read somewhere too that you were getting some Japanese programming coming over, comic books, manga.
Yeah, I had my grandmother send me comic books and tape Japanese television. So a lot of variety shows, a lot of game shows, a lot of anime that's aired on Japanese television and manga. But that's what I grew up with. And then just watching, American TV, I mostly watch sitcoms. Sitcoms and Saturday morning cartoons. Oh, no, actually, I couldn't watch Saturday morning cartoons because I had Japanese school. So, I recorded them. But that's what I pretty much grew up on.
Do you recall some of your favorites?
Some of my favorite in
the US? Either comic books or some of those Saturday morning animated shows.
Saturday morning animated show. I love the Looney Tunes. I love the Saturday Supercade.
Yeah.
Because I love games and, they did cartoon shows about games.
Yeah, it was like Pac-Man. They would always like bringing these game shows to life.
Exactly. Those were great. I remember the theme songs of like, what's it? It's a cartoon show, young and old. It's a Bugs Bunny Roadrunner show or something like that. That was also fun.
And the classics. I love that you love the classics.
And then I just loved watching, coming home from school and watching, like, The Dukes of Hazzard, or like, Three's Company, and just having a blast just watching those for some reason. So
again, the classics.
Yeah, I grew up on the 80s. Come on.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look. To me, there's hardly you can't get better than John Ritter for physical comedy. Yeah. I mean, that's some amazing stuff there. So how did you get into acting then? Or what was the interest in it? Now, I know that it's kind of overlapping here because. Let's see, you graduated in 97?
Yes.
Okay, Bachelor of Science degree in Computer Science and Mathematics.
Yes.
First job after graduation?
Yes.
Industrial Light and Magic?
Yep.
Okay, how does that happen?
Well, that's actually just like a lightning in a bottle because I didn't know what I wanted to do after I graduated. I actually studied a lot of theater arts at Brown as well and kind of like have a minor in it, but I'm just trying to figure out what to do with my life. I didn't know what to do. I thought I was going to go to Microsoft or some of the computer places, but then in the career fair, there was a company called Industrial Light and Magic or Lucasfilm at that time. Lucas Digital that came, and I was looking. Wait a minute. Oh wait, I know Star Wars. That's awesome. Wait, you can make movies on computers? That's kind of cool. And yeah, I took animation, I took computer animation classes, so that's perfect. So basically I kind of applied to ILM and ironically, I took an interview at Microsoft and ILM only, and ILM wouldn't fly me out to San Francisco because they were ILM. So I took an interview for Microsoft so they would pay me to fly out to Seattle and then to San Francisco and then back to Providence.
Oh, that's great. That's fantastic. Okay, what's the job interview like at ILM at that point, at Lucasfilm?
There really wasn't...
Because you're in the world of Star Wars, right? Like, you get all this. That's one of your favorite movies, right?
Yeah, I love Star Wars growing up. I mean...
Okay, are you intimidated walking in, or what's that like?
Actually, not at all, because when I first walked in, there was nothing there. Kerner Optical was like it's a facade for ILM, right? So... It's in a very unassuming like place, and I walk into human resources. I was expecting all these like figures and stormtroopers and Darth Vader and everything. There's nothing. There is nothing. I was walking into a dentist's office, and I was like, "Oh my god, what the hell?" And then they took me across, and I saw this, and I was like, "Really?" I was like, "Oh, this is awesome." But then it's funny because all the entry level jobs, it's like which is called a technical assistant TA jobs. Everybody was super overqualified. They had like PhDs from like UC Berkeley, someone who was a longtime engineer at Silicon Graphics, another master's student from like from MIT. It was like weird. It's like they had all these like high level people there doing. To be honest, that was like the equivalent of bringing coffee to people.
Oh, wow.
So I was actually surprised. I mean, and I wanted the job, I didn't get it right after college, but I think I had to wait like because there was a wait list. So it's only when it opened up, and so I waited 2 months, and I think it came in September, and then I got in. So
okay, so you get the gig at ILM, meet with George Lucas at all, or is that just doesn't happen at that level?
That does not happen at that level. It's, I think there was like in George is very shy, so I remember you. I think in even the handbook it said like you're not allowed to like ask him for autographs or shake hands with him, or like if you make eye contact with him more than like 5 seconds, you're fired or something like that.
That's actually spelled out in materials that they give to you.
I know you're not supposed to ask him for an autograph or something like that. It was something weird in the employee handbook, but yeah, more like I got an advice like don't look him in the eyes, like it's like Medusa or something, like he'll. It's like
was that a thing? Like, did you pass him in hallways and things, or like did that ever come into play?
Not as much because we weren't, I wasn't a supervisor or anything, so we were like peons at that time. So, and he was at the ranch a lot, so
okay,
we didn't have access. Although it's funny like just bumping into like Dennis Muren and like John Knoll, who are the VFX supervisor and the legends. Those were kind of fun.
Okay, I mean, did you get to pick their brain as far as like how did you do it back in the day when you didn't have computers and.
I mean, those are things you really can't really ask, I guess, because they're tired of answering all of that. And like, it feels very unprofessional. So you just kind of read books and learn and just like try to, you get at it from asking from other people.
Okay.
I just remember Dennis Muren, like, he's huge. And I remember like walking along the corridors and like I bumped into him and he just literally just ran right over me. And he was an old man at that time, and yet he just ran right over me. It's like, oh my god, he's so strong.
He's a big guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so the reason I ask about Lucas is because I mean you're actually working on all the Star Wars prequels. I mean you got to work on all three of them, so that had to be okay. How does that? You're in your cubicle, or you're in your edit bay, or how is this work? And then like, how do you know what you're working on for the day? How do you get a gig? How do you get assignments there? Because I'm looking at some of these. I mean, the first one was Mighty Joe Young, and then you're right into Star Wars Episode One.
Right. Well, typically, as technical assistants, you're just assigned stuff. I mean, one way or another, everybody works on Star Wars if you're working on Industrial Light and Magic because it's such a huge show. And I kind of took a different route with the regular TAs because I did a lot of programming, and that's what I was interested in. So I kind of like, because I was kind of like unique among the quote unquote assistants, I didn't want to be a technical director and render shots. I wanted to program and do CG programming. So because I did that, I kind of stood out from everybody else and took a different career path. And I've had a kind of a mentor there, like, Habib Zargarpur, who was my first mentor there. He kind of just pulled me out of, everything and said, hey, come work with me. I want to do these kind of effects and I need a programmer who'll make it happen for me. So you want to just, work on these movies. I'm going to be doing this and then I'm going to be doing that. And basically he took me along for the ride. And then, once you work on, you're never really on a production for, the full duration unless you're a TD or a supervisor. And because I was a programmer, an R&D TD, a research and development TD, I got picked off from show to show to show. It's like I'm there a lot of times in the beginning, and they'll say, "Hey, we need to create, for Star Wars, the prequels." They say, "Hey, we need to be able to destroy an asteroid into a million pieces, shatter it, but also be able to control how things break off at certain times, and have that for animation purposes." So they would bring me in. I would work on a shot in a series or a sequence. Or technology for them. And then I would get, say, hey, we need that for our show. So can you do a derivative of that for this? And then I get pulled on for different productions. So,
okay. So it's kind of an all hands on deck kind of approach to these things. Is there anything in the prequels that's iconic that we would look and you're like, yeah, I did that. Like, you're, or like maybe you're just like sitting with your buddies at the theater watching. I'm like, yeah, that's mine.
Yeah, a lot of it. I mean, as I think in the Boba Fett chase sequence in the Clone War, Attack of the Clones, right. So just what I explained, that big asteroid one where they go boom and then the ring goes boom and destroys that asteroid, that's my shot. That's all, uses all my technology.
Nice.
Of enable that, you know, asteroid to be destroyed in a million pieces and being able to control. Or that, you know, in the factory when they were creating clones, you know, all the machine, the technology that controls that factory conveyor belt and the cloning and all that was mine. And, you know, the perfect storm, you know, all the water shots, you know, my work is in every water shot there because it used my plugins, things like that.
Fantastic. Because that's at a time too when water shots were very tricky to pull off. That, I mean, I think at that point I hadn't seen many movies where I went, yeah, that looks pretty good. But I remember seeing The Perfect Storm and went, oh, okay, they got something right there. So that's you, a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's all about making it visually realistic, but production-wise efficient and cheap. Because it has to be fast, but it has to be visually, it has to look good enough, right? Realistic enough. So it's always finding that balance. And ironically, we're not a software company. So any technology we develop, you know, becomes obsolete in about 3 to 5 years. We need to be on the cutting edge, yet, you know, we can't maintain it. And other software companies will end up, you know, dwarfing whatever we do because we're like a smaller shop. So, so that's kind of like the sad part. It's like we'll create something, but, you know, there's always something newer and faster and better, you know, years down the line.
Well, that's almost like even when you go to your comedy, because you've done improv too, right?
Yes.
I mean, I've talked to improv actors too, and they mentioned, you know, that's the blessing and curse of improv is you create something and then it's completely gone. It's never to be brought back again.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, it's almost like digital improv. Technical director, you mentioned 2003's Hulk movie. You were the technical director on that.
Well, no, technical director is just a term for is a credit term.
Okay.
But I'm pretty much what they call the research and development a specialized technical director who did mostly programming and coming up with the tools and plugins and engines, pretty much.
Did you get to bring the Hulk to life on any level, or was it more just kind of nuts and bolts kind of stuff?
A little bit of nuts and bolts. I think they used – I forgot what I did on that, to be honest with you. So.
Okay. Did you like the Hulk movie?
Yeah. Look, Ang Lee was there the whole time, and he was great. And I thought it was very cool, you know. Eric Bana's performance was a little bit off for me, but you know, it was a cool take on the Hulk that we haven't seen.
I'm a fan of the flick. I liked it when it came out. I never understood the criticism of it. I got that they kind of made the Hulk too big some scenes, but you know,
Don't get me wrong. I think the Avengers did the Hulk amazingly.
Yeah,
right. I mean that's the best. But when we first did the Hulk, I thought it was great. So.
I'm a huge fan of the film. How do you feel that the prequel, Star Wars prequels, and even the Hulk did in sort of combining the worlds of special effects and character development? Because that's always the trick. The Marvel movies are doing it great now. I mean, we're wrapped up in the characters and they got these crazy things going on. How do you think those films did looking back, you know, with a decade plus sort of Monday morning quarterback, that thing?
I mean, looking back, I mean, I didn't know much about storytelling. You know, but we had the greatest animators, and you know, it took a while. I think Pixar were the ones who were great about revolutionizing and bringing characters, emotions, and everything. But it took a while to bring characters to life. I think Star Wars, there was a lot of great development that happened with Episode One in creating worlds and stuff. So the worlds were able to be combined. It's just about being able to bring, you know, characters to life, and you realize it's not just about having great technique and technology, but being able to understand, you know, emotions and character wants and things like that, and becoming so. The animators needed to be actors in many ways because they had to feel for the character and be able to control it. And then the final thing is you have multiple animators working on the same creature, so you got multiple actors trying to play one part. So that's kind of the hard part to keep it consistent. But I think technology-wise, it was just I think Star Wars Episode One did an amazing job of creating worlds and being able to blend, you know, the real world and the CG world.
While you're there, you're starting to take on acting roles then while you're at ILM, different guest shots on a lot of different series?
While I was up at San Francisco, I was working on Perfect Storm at that time. I got my SAG card while I was up there. And because I didn't do dailies, so I didn't have a daily rendering thing, or I was in charge of shots. You know, I had the freedom to go out and quote unquote go auditions. My supervisor knew. But at the same time, I did my work. I would stay in at nights and come on weekends. So I never put production in jeopardy. So they understood that, you know, and that was an understanding. So yes.
When did you first hear about Heroes?
That's when, back in 2006, I was in LA. ILM let me telecommute from LA after I got my SAG card. So I was in LA for about 6 years, just trying to, do my ILM job while auditioning. I got some roles here and there. And then it was actually the year I was ready to quit acting and go back to San Francisco to be a supervisor is when I heard about Heroes.
Oh, wow. Okay. Your character, Hiro Nakamura, wasn't in the original pilot script?
It wasn't in the first incarnation of the pilot script. But for the ones we auditioned, by the time it got to the pilot script being released, yes, it was in it.
Okay, and this was creator Tim Kring's wife had sort of suggested bringing the character in early on?
I think she just read the first draft and she said, wow, everyone's so depressed about having powers. Once they have someone who's actually enjoys it.
And yes, he did. When you first got the script, how did that come into your life? Did you audition? What was all involved? And what did you think about the character of Hiro Nakamura?
It's just it's your typical audition process. You know, because I was a no-name, I had about 30 episodes of television under my belt, but they're all guest spots. So, you know, I wasn't a name like Hayden Panettiere at that time. So I had to go through four rounds of auditions. You had the producers, you have this casting director, you have the producers, studios, and the network. When I read the script, it's like, wow, this is great. You know, if not this, what else? You know, it's like I have a relationship with NBC doing Scrubs. It's comedic. It's Japanese. I speak Japanese, you know, and it's like everything I'd hope for in a script. And it's like, it's just perfect. And it was a positive role too. It wasn't your typical stereotypical, like taking a tourist role or something. So I really thought, well, what else is there? If not this, what else? There's nothing else. So
how much of Hero's arc did you know at that time?
Zero. And Tim Kring didn't know. He was, Hiro was supposed to die in episode 7 or something.
Oh, wow. So you weren't even supposed to be on the entire first season.
Yeah, I mean, I was a series regular, but I was only guaranteed like half the episodes because I think they were going to kill me off. I didn't know that. And Tim kind of mentioned, Hiro's fate was supposed to be a short-lived one, but he all of a sudden became a fan favorite, so he changed his mind.
Okay, that kind of leads me in to a question. From a fanboy's perspective, and then tell me from an actor's perspective, how do you feel about catchphrases?
You know what? I think from a fanboy's perspective, it's necessary. It allows you to kind of like identify with a character and like kind of quote unquote label them. And growing up with Japanese comedy and watching a lot of sitcoms, catchphrases are good because you're reminded of that character. It's a tag. It's a way to quickly identify them. As an actor, it's annoying as hell because you're doing that and that's what you're identified as. So wherever you go, they ask you to do that.
How often are you asked?
I'm asked very often. And at first it was kind of endearing. But after like the 5,000th time, it was like, okay, that's enough.
It kept you alive for a whole season, though.
I know it did, and more.
Yeah.
And it's ironic, because it's my own undoing because I created that catchphrase. So
yeah, tell our listeners a little bit, because what's the catchphrase, and then what was the original catchphrase? I should say.
So it's yata. Originally in the script, it said bonsai. And bonsai means little tree in Japanese. It's, you know, it's like those bonsai trees.
B-O-N-S-A-I.
Yes, that's how it was spelled. And I think Kim wanted to say bonsai, you know, and so the spelling was first of all wrong. And then I was telling Kim, it's like, you know, bonsai, you know, has some like wartime connotations, you know. So can I just make it a little bit modern and kind of say yata, you know. And that's kind of how it started. And then the writers all of a sudden said, yeah, that's a, we should make that a catchphrase. And so wherever, whatever happens, that's what he became.
Like I said, it saved you, but unfortunately, you have to hear it probably every day now, I'd imagine. But it's memorable.
It's pros and cons, you know. I think nowadays it's totally fine. Back when I was a thick of it, it's a little bit different. It's like everywhere you go, that's what they ask you to do. But because you know, you feel like a zoo, part of an animal in a zoo.
As long as you're not like 80 and at a comic convention, and you're still having to yell it out. That's probably not too bad.
Yeah. I'm very grateful for it because of it. Gave me a lot of opportunity and allowed me to meet a lot of great people too. So,
how did you approach playing hero and then future hero?
How did I approach it? You know, I approach any character to be an exaggeration of an aspect of who I am. So for hero, I took the innocence and the childlike wonder I have in me, in my geekiness, and then just kind of like, you know, emphasize that part and kind of like, you know, expanded that. So that's what it is. You know, it's taking like few characteristics of who I am and just kind of making it bigger. So I focus on his like literally his pureness, you know, and trying and just add that. And then future hero, I just made him more jaded. You know, it's like where there's a lot of hope lost and kind of like, and it's future hero is probably another part of who I am, you know, who I was, probably had a chip on his shoulder or been betrayed by many people. So more of the dark side, the dark emotions that I had, and then kind of, bloated that up as well.
We talked about your mad improv skills. How did those skills play out in an early scene with Adrian Pasdar, friend of the show?
Oh, that was like so much fun. I mean, because that was pretty much so much improv was in there. And I think improv is fun because it allows you to be in that character and, you know, play with things. It was hard to do it in Japanese because, you know, my colleague, James Kaisen Lee, he didn't speak Japanese. He wasn't a native speaker. So if I changed certain lines, he wasn't able to keep up with it in Japanese. So it was I couldn't improv as much.
And this is like the diner scene early on?
Yeah, the diner scene early on. But in English, I was able to improv a lot. So, you know, I got to play along with, you know, with Adrian. And that was a lot of fun. We actually drove up to the set like the night before. And then just like stay there and like actually rehearsed, you know. But then because of that rehearsal, we had a rapport. We just tried a lot of things on set, and that was great because you know the producers and the writers allowed us to experiment and play around.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because it's apparently Tim Kring, the creator, he was open to a lot of that. Because sometimes, I mean, you talk to actors who work on Joss Whedon projects, and it's like these words are the words, and you can't. Even your co-star Milo Ventimiglia on Gilmore Girls, yes. You know those words were law.
come to find out, there are some places that the words are law. But what Tim was great at is Tim was great at creating the characters, and he told us that we're going to know as actors, we're going to know our characters much better than he does. So own it and make it yours. You know, and as long as we hit the story beats and say the important things, you know. They're going to get it, but they were always open to us adding stuff, and which made it such a creative and collaborative process. Sometimes they were, you know, of course not used, you know, but there were oftentimes they were used, and you know, it's just great to feel like you're part of that creative process.
Special guests on Heroes. I mean, you get into these superhero shows, there's always some very cool guests coming up. Season one, Stan the Manly.
Yes.
Okay. Talk about working with Stan. I know it was very brief on there, but talk about working with Stan. And then did you talk about X-Men at all? Because Heroes, boy, very, very much in the sort of the world of the X-Men.
Right. Stan, well, first of all, you know, Stan came on because he's great friends with Jeff Loeb, you know, the Marvel world. And ironically, I think we were the first ones to start the Stan Lee cameo on all his related projects, right? I think
I think there was an Incredible Hulk Bixby movie where he popped in. So technically he was in that, but you got one of the very early ones, yes.
Got it. Well, I just
he was like a jury member in one of the Bixby Ferrigno TV movies.
All I know is Stan is a ham. My God.
No, Stan Lee? Shocking.
It's funny because like he would have one line and he complained to Jeff. He was like, why do I only have one line? I should have more. And it was just really funny. We didn't really get to talk much about X-Men, you know, because he's a busy man and everything. But it was just kind of cool to see him and have him be there. You know, he's a legend, of course. So it's just very cool.
George Takei. Boy, you got a little bit more screen time with him than with Stan Lee. Were you a Star Trek fan coming into this?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if I'm a Trekkie versus a Star Wars guy, I am officially a Star Wars guy. But I grew up watching Star Trek as well. And, you know, especially George, he's a legend when it comes to Asian American actors and having paved the way for us. So,
did you get to pick George's brain at all about his time in Hollywood, his projects, working in a huge sci-fi series with an incredible fan base?
You know what? It's one of those things I regret. I wish I asked him more. But, you know, as I said, there are people who like to tell war stories and people who don't. So if it happened to go in that direction, yes, I asked him more. But typically I didn't initiate that conversation as much, you know, out of respect for his time. But, you know, it's definitely I got a lot of advice from him regarding, being part of an SF show and also being an Asian American actor.
What was the best piece of advice he gave you that you still take with you today and try to pass on to others?
I think just really enjoy everything. You know, the fans, especially with the fans, you know, the fans mean a lot and they'll be with you for a long time. So, you know, show a lot of respect and love for the fans.
How do you feel the writer's strike impacted the second season? Because you guys were red hot going into this and then the brakes just had to be put on out of your control.
Yeah, it is out of our control. And unfortunately, it kind of, I think, derailed us a little bit in some senses. We couldn't tell the story that, you know, that we wanted to tell. And I feel bad for the writers in particular, you know, because they had to all of a sudden shift gears and change everything. I can't say it didn't impact us. It definitely did. It has some impact for us.
Do you have any favorite storylines or episodes or moments or even behind the scenes stuff from the original Heroes? Because I mean, you had the whole arc of going back to feudal Japan. I mean, Hero is completely different from season to season almost. He's just kind of like all over the place, especially time traveling.
Yeah, and that's why it's kind of fun because they allow the character to grow, you know. But it's such a fast pace, you know, and move things. But probably my favorite storyline had to be, I mean, season one is still the best. I loved his, his storyline with Charlie and having future Hero come in. I mean, that first season is just immortal in many ways. I also love this stuff with his mother. You know, it's funny. There's a lot of mother things with, you know, in 5-0 as well. And just like the very emotional storylines. And I try to make those as personal as I can, but, you know, I would say those were my favorite storylines in Heroes.
Well, you kind of got to play that out a little bit in Heroes Reborn, too. You got kind of, I mean, Hero becomes paternal.
Yes.
And that. What was your reaction when you first heard about Heroes Reborn?
It was actually a surprise, because when we saw that, that commercial during the Winter Olympics, all of the castmates, all of a sudden, it's like, what the hell just happened? And we all texted each other, anyone heard about this? And it was the first time like I heard back from like Zach or Hayden in a long time. It's like,
that happen? How does this get announced? And you're not called ahead of time. How is it like you're finding out when we're finding out? That's just so mind blowing to me.
Well, it's Hollywood.
There you go. Okay, so you unfortunately were you supposed to be in the entire series, the entire 13 episodes originally? Was that the thought?
That was a thought, yes.
Okay. But because of your contractually obligated work on Hawaii 5-0, you weren't able to do that out. How did that sort of morph into the couple of episodes that you were in? What were the initial conversations you had, and then where did those end up being?
Well, I can't really talk about that in detail, but I'm just very happy that NBC and CBS were able to work it out. You know, Peter was always trying to help and trying to make it work out so I'd be in both shows at the same time, you know. But, you know, legally there were contractual issues, so it was just hard. But
what were the challenges in coming back to a role after being away for so long?
I think the two main challenges is, one, it wasn't my show anymore. It was like I was a guest of the show, so for me it was kind of like passing the torch. So I wanted to make show respect by doing what I need to do and say thanks to the fans, but also pass on the torch so the Heroes World can live on even without us. So that was the thing, and it was an interesting experience. It's like you forgot what it's like, and it's a different atmosphere. So I think I wish everybody was on the show, but I was just happy that I got to see Jack, Greg, and at least Sendel and work with them again.
What did you channel to become like Dad Hero?
Not much. It's mostly just taking.
You did it well. I'm just.
Well, thank you. But it was taking Future Hero, and then ironically, I think I channeled Adrian a lot because I don't have a father figure, so for me, it was always about the happy dad was Greg Brumberg, and the more like rough dad was Adrian Pasdar in my mind, because I've always saw them, and I hung out with their family and how they dealt with their kids, so that was my vision. So I kind of imagine Adrian in some senses.
When we last saw our hero, things did not look good. What do you know about his fate?
I have no idea.
Have a little bit of idea. You had to, like, when you're shooting your last scene, you had to go, like, okay, I won't tell anybody, but what happens after this?
Well, really nothing. I mean, they left it as a cliffhanger, but let's put it this way. If there was a season two, Hero would have been back.
In what form do you think?
I don't know.
As a fanboy, what would you like to see Hero? If you were writing it, if they said episode one next season written by Masioka, where do you pick up Hero? Or if you're writing a comic book, if you're maybe writing a sequel comic book.
Of Reborn?
Yeah. Where would you put Hero? How would you get him out of that, and what would he be doing?
In Reborn, it would probably be, I would want younger Hero to come, break the time continuum and meet with like Grandpa Hero and kind of like start a whole new parallel universe. Kind of like what Star Trek did in the movie franchise.
All right. You got all kinds of crazy time travel things. It could happen. So maybe we'll see this. Latest projects. We've got Death Note.
Yes.
Going back to your love of manga.
Yes, I'm producing that, so I'm very excited about
that.
What
do we need to know about Death Note, and when can we see it?
I saw a first studio cut of it. It looks great. I think we're still working on it, but Adam Wingard just did a phenomenal job, and so did all of our actors. So it's an anime adaptation, a live action anime adaptation that I'm proud of. It's not a straight up adaptation or recreation, like Watchmen or anything like that. Or probably Ghost in the Shell, but I'm really excited about the tone that Adam took, and it's very different. It's very unique and stylized.
Feature or series?
It's a feature.
It's a feature, and this is going to be on Netflix. So, yes. If it works out, possibly some more following it?
Yeah, if it works out, that would be great.
And also the world of sci-fi, thriller Meg.
Yes.
What do we need to know about that?
Coming out in 2018, Jason Statham, star, very international cast. I get to be operating a submarine kind of like machine, and a lot of cool things happen. We see a big shark.
Okay, this is a shark flick.
It's a shark flick. It's
how big is the shark? Oh, it's Jurassic Shark.
Yeah, it's a lot bigger than I thought. To be honest with you, when I first heard the movie, it's like, oh, okay, this is like Sharknado. La-di-da. And then I hear it's like, oh, it's a Warner Brothers film. Okay, so it's actually going to be a real film. And then I hear, it's like $150 million budget or something like that.
Wow.
Like, oh my God, it's a real, real movie. So,
is there a part of you as an actor that, like, when you're on set, are you looking over at the monitor going, okay, I would digitally render this way? Or, like, are you giving any feedback? Or are you like, where? How does actor Mossy sometimes, compared to yes. technical wizard Mossy?
Actor Mossy turns off technical wizard Mossy. So he doesn't get in the way. When I'm an actor, I get paid to say my lines and, you know, create words and be a character. So if I'm a producer, it's a different story. But if I'm an actor, everybody does an amazing job, and it's not my place to kind of like, you know, comment on other things. So I take in what they have and make it real. That's my job. So
fair enough. And technical nerd Mossy, Mobius Digital Games. That's where technical nerd Mossy comes in, right?
Yes. And a lot of startups that I'm working with, IoT and VR companies. But, you know, Mobius Digital Games is my company. And then we're working on a game called Outer Wilds that's hopefully coming out later this year.
Okay. And this is, what do we need to know about this game? What's it about? How do we get it?
It's like Groundhog Day in space. So it's Groundhog Day in space, but the game is missed. So wait, it's Groundhog Day missed in space is what the best way to put it.
Was that the elevator pitch?
That would be the elevator pitch, yes. Nice. It actually won the IGF Independent Game Festival Award last year. So,
sweet.
You know, okay. It's a critical darling in that sense that one of my, our employees, Alex Beecham, created while at USC. So we're making the full-blown version of that.
Right tail now. End of this year, 2017, we can look for that?
Yeah, it should be around summer, June or August, I would think.
Okay, how do we find out about all these things, and how do we find out more about you? Social media, websites, give them all to us.
Probably social media is the best. I have my Twitter account, which is at Masioka, M-A-S-I-O-K-A, and Instagram is at MASI_OKA. And then I think there's a website, www.mobiusdigitalgames.com.
So between one of those, we'll find out all about these things and big, giant Jurassic sharks.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be tweeting a lot. So.
Sounds good. Well, look, Mossy, continued success. Looking forward to all of these projects, these games, these movies, giant sharks. It's all going to be cool. Thank you so much for joining me on Comic Book Central today.
Thanks, Joe. Appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Mossy's final episode of Hawaii Five-O. If you haven't seen it, be sure to check it out. It's very cool. It's a nice send-off, a nice little moment there as well. It's streaming on CBS.com, so go get it. Check it out. Of course, all the episodes are available on DVD and Blu-ray. You can go get the sets, as is Heroes. All those episodes are out there as well, so go get them. And season one, man, I have to agree with Mossy. Season one of Heroes, epic. It is a fun ride. If you haven't seen it, be sure to get it. You're also going to want to check out Mossy Online. Links to his social media pages and to his website that he mentioned, those can all be found in the show notes for this episode at my website, comicbookcentral.net. So if you want to find out what's going on, check out the show notes. All the links are there. I'll put them in there for you. My thanks to Mossy Oka for joining us today. So glad he was able to take some time out of his day to spend that with us. And my thanks to each and every one of you out there for listening. Man, I appreciate you taking the time to make Comic Book Central a part of your day. You listeners are the best. Folks, more comic booky goodness is headed your way. If you are a regular listener, but you haven't yet subscribed to the show on iTunes, or if you're a new listener, maybe you're a Mossy Oka fan, just checking out Comic Book Central for the first time. Welcome, if you are. Be sure to click that iTunes link on the homepage, comicbookcentral.net. You click subscribe in iTunes, you get each and every episode that's in the archive. They're also on the website in the archive there. You can download them there as well. But subscribe in iTunes. You get them each and every week. Those Heroes Conversations are out there. So if you haven't checked them out yet, be sure to go back and check them out. Over 150 episodes just waiting to be downloaded. So go back and get the ones you missed. Or if you're new to the show, go back and enjoy them. When you subscribe, you put yourself in line to get each and every episode that's coming up as well, including the return of Flashback, Flash Forward February. That's right. Fantastic, flashy fun with the enormous talents who bring the world of the Scarlet Speedster to life. That's coming up. We're just weeks away from that. Subscribe on iTunes. Give us a like on Facebook. Follow Comic Book Central on Twitter. Blueberry Stitcher, those services as well. If you're not using iTunes, we're out there as well. And share the lair. Get these episodes out to your friends, to your family, all the folks at the local comic book store, your workmates, your schoolmates, anybody. Share the lair. Don't forget. Share it. More giveaways are on the way, so that's coming your way. You might be selected to get one of those giveaways that's coming up, too, so you never know. Be sure to check it out. You want to know what else is on the way? I can't tell you just yet. Can't tell you just yet. Working on something big. It's scheduled to happen in the next few days. I want to make sure I lock that in. I'm working on that, folks, for you. I haven't yet locked it into the Lair's data bank here. But stay tuned to social media. Like I said, check out Facebook and Twitter. Make sure you're following Comic Book Central there. You will know when and if it happens. I'm hoping to be able to bring that surprise to you for the very next episode. So stay tuned for that. Until then, as Iron Man himself, Robert Downey Jr., said at the People's Choice Awards, go Steelers! Man, I hope they win this weekend. Keep reading those comics. Thanks for joining me here in the Lair. Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content in this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Imported License. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of the respective holders.
Super Gay Time, join all the Super Gay Fun.